campaign volumes, and you get to pay it forward. You get a second copy of your selected gift for a school, college, university, teacher, or just another friend. You get to decide. Newly restored voices from our collection will inspire you as they did when they were first heard. Alan Watts, Dick Gregory, Amiri Baraka, Maya Angelou, Bob Dylan, Adrian Rich, Malcolm X, Anais Nin, and hundreds more. The Campus Campaign coming soon this holiday season, November 18th and 19th, on your Pacifica radio station. This is Brian DeShazer for the Pacifica Radio Archives.
And it is a few seconds past midnight here at WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. And we present next at least the first two-thirds of Night Shift with Mike Sargent.
Sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. And I'm here with Fernando. Fernando, you want to say something? That was Fernando. And Fernando's master. Hello, Fernando's master.
I'm everyone's master.
And Byron Saunders.
I'm not on the, what do I call it?
Listen, I got him tongue-tied.
You're on the air.
I'm on the air. Yes,
yes, you're on the air.
I'm not doing radio.
This is the radio show, Byron. I know that, you are technically on assignment.
Oh, okay, so this is technically fitting right in with my job description.
Well, we've come to visit you at your assignment,
Excellent. Yes.
Because we love you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So, Byron. First of all, I have a number of things we're going to talk about here, but this is the Night Shift movie special.
Ooh.
I have interviews with half a dozen directors and producers and actors from a number of films some that are coming out this week, some that just came out, some that you have to watch because they're traveling around the country.
Yes.
But all of that here and more.
More?
On Night Shift?
On Night Shift.
Oh, my goodness. SOMG, peoples.
did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
Mm-hmm. I have been writing stories since I was a little girl. It's funny, too, because my parents came down for the premiere of Love and Basketball, and they brought this short story I wrote when I was 9 years old. They had saved it, and to read that and see that little story, it was actually about a turkey on Thanksgiving who pretended they were a pig so they wouldn't be eaten. So the fact that they saved that and recognized and always encouraged that in me. And as I got older, I thought I wanted to write for soap operas. I used to watch five a day, and I heard how much money they make as well. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I got into college at UCLA that my aspirations got a little bigger, and saw film as a really great way to tell stories, because the format is so big. You go in the theater, it's dark, you're totally enveloped, and you really enter a new world. I always thought that was really cool.
And why do you think we as human beings need to tell each other stories?
Wow. Honestly, I feel film can change you. A great film can change you. It can change your thinking. It could change who you are. It can change the conversation, which is what I'm hoping for this film. And it's just important to be able to put yourself into other people's shoes. And again, I love to go to a great film and lose myself in it and discover new worlds, new people, new ways of life. I think it's important because it brings us, film has the ability to bring us together.
Thank you.
So we're back. Now, I had a couple questions for both of you.
Yes,
we're here. Now, you don't really... Do you really care, like, around this time of year about what movies come out, Elena? Because this is the time of year where they start releasing all the, you know, all the Oscar contenders and all the great dramas and the movies that are... The prestige films come out this time of year. Do you pay attention now, or you don't really care?
No, I do really care. Those are the ones that I, like, seek out. And I usually base it on who's in it.
Okay. So is there anything coming out that you're excited about?
Not particularly. I haven't seen anything that's really, like, struck my fancy.
What about you, Byron? Is there anything you're excited to go see?
The sci-fi movies, of course. I like those. And there are a couple that I've seen trailers for. I can't think of the names of them that come out around Christmas time. Always there's something unique at the Christmas time things.
Well, Into the Woods is coming out.
Yeah.
Hunger Games,
yeah, right, exactly.
Interstellar just came out.
Interstellar came out.
I'll talk about that. Right. I'll give them a review.
Right.
So.
But you know what? I saw a trailer up the other day that was like, wow, this should have been played last month. Well, so.
Yeah, that's good.
Oh, that's good.
That comes out Christmas Day.
Amazing.
You're ready.
Amazing.
You're ready.
Yeah.
Byron's ready.
Because I know the people who. We're part of that. I know,
right.
You know, Hosea Williams was my mentor. And he led the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge with John Lewis. So
that's the film you're most excited about.
Most excited.
Okay, even more than the science fiction.
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
And Elena, there's nothing you don't pay. You know there'll be good stuff, but you don't already think.
Yeah, anything can stumble into that.
All right, well, there are a few films that have already come out that are I kind of Oscar tennis, and I'm going to go to the first interview. The first one is this film called The Theory of Everything, which, of course, we have to do something on Night Shift because it's about Stephen Hawking, and it's about him as a young man. When he was first diagnosed with the type of ALS he has, they gave him 2 years to live, and he had just fallen in love with this woman who was, you know, brilliant in her own right, in her own field. And, you know, she made the very brave decision of sticking with him. And she signed on, thinking he had 2 years to live. Now, as we know, he is still with us, okay? But it's a fascinating story because it's based on her memoirs of what her life was like. And, you know, it's pretty trying to have to live with someone. But I have to say, Eddie Redmayne is... There's a point where you're watching a movie where you forget you're watching an actor. You just feel you're watching Stephen Hawking. He's got it so down. It's such a convincing performance that it's uncomfortable to watch at certain points.
Right.
Because you really, like you think about what it would be to be trapped in your body with all these thoughts and very difficult for you to communicate, you know, one letter at a time. So, it's a good movie. The director is James Marsh, and he did one of my favorite spy films of late. And what is the name of the movie? Shoot. Shadow Dancer. Clive Owen, Andrea Riseborough. But he first came into claim as a director of this movie called Man on a Wire. So he's a documentary filmmaker, so he really takes an interesting approach to filmmaking. So I have an interview with him for The Theory of Everything. I also have an interview with him. Did you see him?
Yes.
Yes, that was
it. Fascinating.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Yes.
I'm not too into it.
Really? So you didn't see him in
Yes.
Love It?
I did saw him in Love It.
Did you like the movie better?
Yes.
No.
Did you see the movie?
Yes.
Did you like the movie?
No.
No, Byron didn't like the movie.
I for reasons that are more about the artistic choices made than the storyline, I get it. I mean, I'm into the French Revolution, and I really appreciate that storyline by itself. I saw Les Mis on the touring circuit, this Broadway show coming on tour. But comparing them, yeah. Movies that do musicals have a hard way of translating and transitioning. I think one of the few movies that actually works as a musical is Chorus Line, because it has that, it already has, it's segmented enough that you can chop it up and put it on the film and still keep the story intact. Les Mis is something else, because every time they were ready to sing, I was like, okay.
Well, they've done it. They did it as a non-singing version with...
But Chorus Line, I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt.
I forget the French actor that's in it. Gerard Depardieu, yes.
He's awesome.
I like him. I like him a lot.
He was in the non-singing version.
I know.
What were you going to say later before we did this interview?
Chorus Line. Chorus Line was campy to begin with. So when you put it, it's like, you know, you can't.
Well, Byron likes corn. Byron's a corn.
And actually, I think I lied. I don't even think I saw Les Mis, so I don't mean to retract my answer. But wow. Now I feel really guilty.
Lie. All right. When we come back, Elena won't be here because she lied.
There's a little play gun here that's going to go to my head. So after all, I'm like thinking, why did I say I saw that?
Because you wanted to sound sophisticated. You wanted to sound educated.
Exactly. I did see the musical on stage, and I didn't like it. So tell me.
Wait a minute. So you didn't see the movie?
No.
So you just gave a review of a movie you didn't see?
Yes, basically. And wow. I'm retracting my answer.
Elena?
Yes.
You're a very strange woman. All right, we're going to our interview with James Marsh, the director of The Theory of Everything, here on listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. All right, you tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and here with James Marsh, who's the director of The Theory of Everything. James, welcome to WBAI.
Pleasure to be here.
So I have a few questions for you. First of all, as I mentioned to you, I'm a big fan, and there's different films you've made that I love for different reasons. But I want to know, when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
What an interesting question. When I grew up, we didn't have a television when I grew up as a child. And also, I wasn't allowed to go and see films. That wasn't allowed in my household. So the power of cinema, when I finally got to engage with it, was, for me, an overwhelming thing. And so the impact of cinema when I was young was so powerful. The emotions I felt were so strong. I thought, what an amazing medium that you can have this impact on someone by telling a story. So that was sort of the first... It was a recognition of the power of the medium, that I wanted to be a part of that medium and have that power myself, I guess.
Okay. Then I have a couple more contextual questions like that. Why do you think we as human beings need to tell stories?
Well, we tell stories all the time. We just do. You know, I'll go home today and tell my kids what I did today. It'll be like a story. Stories tend to have, you know, stories that are valuable, that have a kind of meaning beyond that kind of story, are ones that, I guess, involve conflict, involve choices and decisions that we all face in different ways in our lives all the time. And a story can dramatize and distill those things that happen in our lives generally into, you know, a much shorter time frame. And they're built from choices and decisions that characters make. And we are able to invest, I guess, in those choices and decisions and extract often something valuable from them, good or bad. So they're in our nature. Just embedded, every culture has storytelling as a part of its culture, literally.
Yes, it does.
And what's amazing is when you have kids, if you have kids, and how immediately they latch onto stories. That's the first thing you do, is read them stories. And they want to hear the same story over and over again when they're younger. They can't believe it's a story, it seems, and therefore they're surprised every time they hear the same story. Kids will often read the same book for like 3 months. You read the same story over and over again. And so you discover the joy of narrative, I guess, at a very, very early age. It's almost like language. It's in our DNA, in our brain wiring, to want and need stories.
I agree with you 100%. And my last question like that is, what, in your estimation, makes a good story and a story worth telling?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I can only answer it based on my own sort of storytelling choices.
Sure.
And as a documentary filmmaker, I tended to respond to stories that seem totally unbelievable. And because they're true and real, you can't negotiate with that. And so I made a film called Man on Wire about a French artist who strings a tightrope in the Twin Towers and walks on it for almost an hour at the top of the Twin Towers when they were still there. And if someone said that happened, you wouldn't believe it. But it happened, and therefore I have to reckon with that as a documentary filmmaker. In dramatic films, I've just made one, as you know, Theory of Everything now, which is vaguely a true story, but it's definitely a true story, but it's dramatized. And it felt to me that in this true story that you could explore the emotional life of this relationship between Stephen Hawking and his wife, which is what the focus of the film actually is, better in a dramatic form than you could in a documentary. In a documentary, I think people couldn't remember emotional details the way that a screenwriter can write them. And also, you'd have to be there and observe that relationship, you know, as it happened, for it to be a truthful documentary, as opposed to a retrospective, reconstructed idea of this marriage. So in this particular story, that's a very good way of exploring a true story, is through the dramatic writing of Anthony McCartan. And the stories you're drawn to, I think, are ones that move you, that obsess you, and you know you're going to spend 2 years thinking about, and they have to support, you think, 2 years of obsessive thinking. So that's why I respond to and why I do the work I do.
Well, you actually kind of said something I was going to ask you, because it seems to me that most of your stories that you've done, documentaries or otherwise, deal with people doing what most people would think would be impossible.
True enough. And here's another example, too. Our story in this case is the story. It's a portrait of a marriage in very unusual circumstances. Jane Hawking falls in love with an able-bodied student and marries someone who then marries someone who's condemned, she thinks, to live just for 2 years. And that's a choice she makes, which, again, is an extraordinary choice, and that creates its own story itself. And of course, Stephen doesn't die. They live, and they have a very complicated marriage that gets increasingly under pressure, and third parties become part of that marriage too. It all becomes very complicated. So that is essentially the emotions of that are what our story generates, if you like.
Well, now I'm curious. Now, you as a documentary filmmaker, you bring to me some of the techniques of documentary filmmaking to a narrative film. What would you say you learned as a storyteller that you've been able to bring to doing narrative films that you probably may not have approached in the same way if you weren't a documentary filmmaker?
Well, definitely, I tended to make dramatic films that have some inspiration in real life, mm-hmm. either loosely or, in this case, quite specifically. And I think you become very concerned about details in your as you make a dramatic film, that leaders feel right to you, they feel authentic to the situation that you're in. And we were able to study archive film and photographs, the existence of Stephen Hawking and his wife, that we were able to make our sets exactly like the photographs that we'd seen. So that's something that helps you as a dramatic filmmaker, just to feel that things are right. Also, in documentaries, you're dealing with human behavior often that you've observed in a certain kind of way, and that helps you understand the truthfulness of actors, that you're looking for behavior that feels truthful from the actors. And by God, I got it in this particular film. The acting, I think, is extraordinarily good from both Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones, who do the best work I've ever seen them do in this film. So you look for that truth too. And I think, you know, what the difference in the two media are really that the means of production is very different. A feature film is much bigger scale, and it happens in a much more compressed time frame. But actually, the objective is very similar, to tell the story as well as you can and as visually as you can. And that's true to both documentaries and to feature films.
Well, again, that makes complete sense to me. Now, maybe a two-part question here. How involved were Hawking and his former wife in the production of this? And what was it that you felt was the most important to bring out in this story?
Well, the film is inspired by Jane's memoir, her account of meeting Stephen and living with Stephen and marrying Stephen. So that's her point of view. So that's already a big part of the story and a big flavour in the story. Anthony McCartan spent quite a few years talking to Jane about the idea of a film and getting her comfortable with that idea. It took a long time, and writing the screenplay. I then met with Jane when I got involved in the film, and she was very helpful. She took me on a very interesting sort of tour of Cambridge, the world that she and Stephen lived in Cambridge, England. And she would point out all the kind of buildings that had no wheelchair access in the 60s when she was first with Stephen, and all the impediments you'd encounter if you had a wheelchair in Cambridge, all the difficult steps and stones and pavings and things you'd meet. He took me to the house where they were first, when they were married, they first lived in, which we reproduced in exactly the same, and took me to a room, a bedroom, where Stephen had a moment you see in the film where he discovers an idea. He's tangled up in his pajamas, he can't escape from them because he's unable to move his hands and arms properly, and he has an amazing idea for his work in that situation. And I saw that room, that bedroom, and that sort of informs your just how you can do something. So Jane had that involvement with the film. Stephen was much less involved going into the film. We showed him a screenplay as an act of courtesy, and he didn't object to the screenplay. That was about as much as he'd been offered at that point.
That's pretty strong, though.
Yes. And so he gave us his sort of, understated sort of approval for this, but not enthusiastic approval. We then invited him to come to the set, and there's a very extravagant scene in the film on a May ball, which is a kind of summer party at a Cambridge college. And that was on a certain kind of scale in the film. And I think he was impressed with the fact it wasn't just a miserable little TV show. We were doing something quite big here. And then when the film was almost finished, we had to invite him to come and see the film, which is probably the most nerve-wracking 2 hours of my life.
Sure.
I wasn't able to be in the room. I couldn't. I had to basically leave. We got him into the screening room. I came back to find out what he made of it. And his first observation was he felt broadly true to him. And that's about as good as it gets from a film biography of a person who's living, broadly true. He then later emailed us to tell us that at certain points he thought he was watching himself on screen. Eddie's performance was so convincing that he kind of bought into it as being him. And then as a result of that screening, he offered us the use of his actual voice, his electronic voice he's known for, the signature machine voice that we all know. At that point, we're using our own version of that. We've made our own sort of electronic version of that voice. And he gave us that voice, and that felt like a sign of approval, that he was happy for this film to have been made. And that voice changed the film. It was in a very mysterious way. It just became better with his actual voice. And towards the end of the film, we have his electronic voice playing. So I think both Jane and Stephen have seen the film now and are comfortable with it.
Well, that's got to be very gratifying.
It's a relief, to be honest with you. They didn't like it. You'd feel very, very uncomfortable about that if you'd made a film that without living people and they'd objected to it in some violent way. I'd feel very bad about that.
Well, I want to touch upon something you mentioned earlier. You talked about the emotional impact of movies and how it affected you, and you've done that to me several times. I particularly, my favorite film of yours is Shadow Dancer. I thought that was...
How nice is it? It's not a film that, wasn't a widely seen film that, but it was certainly a film that... it was very rewarding to make that film. I learned a lot doing it, and I worked with some great actors on that film too. That's a film that involves a lot of uncomfortable feelings of anxiety and dread and betrayals within a family in a very uncomfortable way. It's betraying your own family is probably the worst thing you can do, and yet this woman in the film has a reason to do that. So coming from that film to this was, even this film is about an awful illness that blights people's lives and affects people who care for people who suffer from ALS. And oddly enough, this was a much more optimistic film than that film. The emotional palette was more agreeable and forgiving, because each character in this story has good intentions, even if they hurt each other and even if things don't end up being a happy ever after kind of story. Everyone is coming with a good motive here, and that was kind of refreshing after doing such a dark film beforehand.
It's interesting because you took some of the words again out of my mouth. Of the feelings I had watching the film was just that uncomfortability of it. It's hard to watch in many ways, I felt, because you care about these characters and what they're going through, you empathize, and it's not a fun feeling. I'm curious, the balance between telling the story and illustrating what he had to go through so you don't go too far. How difficult was that?
Well, that's a very interesting way of putting it, because it felt like a balancing act too, that you wanted to keep the focus on the relationship and the ebb and flow of this relationship under these circumstances, but that relationship is changing because of the illness and because of Stephen's career and because he's becoming more
public.
And his
longevity too.
And his longevity, which wasn't part of the original understanding of either character going into this marriage, and in our story, or indeed probably in real life, Stephen expects to die within 2 years. Jane expects to marry someone that she loves and watch that person fade away very quickly. That's one thing, and that's terrible. What they get is something beyond that. You know, they, Stephen is alive to this day. We have a happy ending, if you like, in our film, because he's alive. But the, you know, the complications of the relationship under this progressive illness, and I think the complications of Stephen's success too. For every success Stephen has, Jane has a burden. That to go to travel is very hard. You know, to go to America, to go and collect an award, or for Stephen to give a lecture somewhere. It's Jane with her three children and her burdens that has to take the brunt of this. And this puts stresses on the marriage, clearly. And when a third party comes into that marriage, in both real life and the story, that third party comes to help the couple. He's not coming to prey upon them. He's not coming to wreck their marriage. He's coming to help them. And my solution, if you like, to how this could be understood and have sympathy for each character in that in this strange triangle was for Stephen to fall in love with that character first, for Stephen to accept Jonathan's help and assistance and cherish him for that. And the connection between those two characters in the film is very warm. And Stephen eventually gives his permission for this triangle to exist, for each of them to get some support out. It's a very unusual love story in that respect, to have a love triangle where permission is sort of being given, and but people are still being hurt, no question, in that triangle.
And through no necessarily fault of their own.
Absolutely, no malice.
No malice, exactly.
No intentional malice.
No intentional malice.
Quite the opposite, in fact.
Yes. Let me also ask you this now, and this is maybe somewhat more personal. For you, I kind of believe that as you define your art defines you. What did you learn about yourself in the making of a film like this?
That's what an interesting question. I mean, there are two obvious things that are given in the territory you're in. One is the nature of Stephen's illness and the impact that has on people who care for those. And I met those people. Eddie met many, many people that way. And, you know, in a film, you can get a film production, you can feel like you have all these worries and you're constant anxiety with this problem, that problem, and you can get very lost in your own problems. And we kept saying to ourselves, so often as we were shooting, well, I can get out of bed in the morning and walk to the bathroom, and I can walk here. And there's so many people we've now met who cannot do that, who are losing their lives every day. And I remember saying to Eddie one day, well, that guy we met, well, guess what? He's going to be worse off now. That was a month ago that you met him. And now he's, so this was not to kind of create some false humility here, but it was definitely something that I was very aware of and began to see the world through a disabled person's eyes and how patronizing people are, disabled people. It's not their minds that have gone, it's their bodies in this illness. So to patronize someone intellectually because they're in a wheelchair is the worst thing you can do. And that was an interesting sort of corrective to your understanding of this disability. The other part of it, of course, is the whole where do we come from, what does the universe mean side of thing, the big ineffable questions of life. Will we ever understand this, which this question Stephen's asking? So you can't help but begin to ask those questions yourself and end up, you know, at a certain point you're in lonely hotel rooms thinking about the nature of the universe and where it started and what your position is in it and how insignificant you are in the scheme of things, and then you just say, well, I'm going to open a beer here and watch television.
Right,
that's
right.
All I can do. I can need to live in the moment now. So that's a takeaway, perhaps, is, you know, as Stephen does, living in the moment, something we always remind ourselves to do, but we forget so often. Enjoy every day. Carpe diem. It's really true.
Sure. Now, I also have to ask, you know, as you were working on the finishing of this film, the ALS challenge just became
huge. It did, actually. They were a company. Particularly in post-production, became very aware of it. Eddie's done one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm due for one, I'm sure, soon enough. And that's something that, you know, it was just a coincidence that we're making a film about probably the most famous person with this spectrum of illness, which is a spectrum. It's not one particular, every symptom is the same. It's, you know, it's a wide spectrum of symptoms that people have. And so if, in a small way, our film can help that awareness, then that's good for us, you know, and good for the world, rather.
Sure. Well, then that must make you believe a little bit in fate, then.
Indeed. Well, it's an interesting coincidence, and one that, you know, I'm sort of pleased with, because it's all raising awareness of what is a really devastating illness for people who lose their lives that way, and again, the people who have to endure and care for is seeing someone they love, you know, fade and die the way that they do. It's really a terrible, terrible illness.
Well, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
See, they're giving me the signal. I very much
enjoy it. Very nice. You have a great radio voice.
Thank you.
I can listen to you all day.
So, we're back, and in a few minutes, I'm going to play my interview with Gina Prince-Blythewood, who is the director of Beyond the Lights, which is a really good film, with starring Gugu Mbatha-Raw and Nate Parker. And it's about a young girl who becomes a singer and kind of has to, you know, become over-sexualized and become successful, and what's the cost, you know? So, but you're saying something, Byron, off-air, you were saying something about aliens and abductions.
And UFO sightings.
And UFO sightings.
Yeah, they started to multiply.
We're going to have a guest on soon who was abducted, and as a result of being abducted, he became an artist.
Interesting.
Yes. The aliens gave
formerly known as
Elena.
Elena, exactly. I like Elena, if Elena had, like, revealed she was abducted, would anybody be surprised?
No,
nobody
would
be like, oh, well, of course,
of course
Elena.
She was abducted.
We know you were abducted. As a matter of fact, we've thought you may still be abducted.
Perhaps.
And not really here.
Yeah,
recently, I have evolved with less hair on my body.
Oh.
In those certain special places.
Oh.
So maybe they've returned me. Yeah, they've transplanted your consciousness into this new body. This is like a pod body.
Yes.
My outer space wax.
Okay.
So, now, did you like Love and Basketball, Byron?
Loved it.
You loved it.
Yes.
You're a fan.
I loved it, yes.
And did you see the movie? Did you see the movie? Love and Basketball? You never saw it.
No. And I'm saying honestly
okay, honestly, no. Don't. She's going to give a review. She'll be like, what's his name? Buckwheat. He used to give a review of the film based on the trailer.
I haven't done that. No.
You were worse. At least Buckwheat saw the trailer. You're like, no, I didn't like it. I hated it. Piece of crap.
I said I liked it.
All right, I didn't see it. Damn, you're like the people who protest those movies that they haven't seen, but they
I didn't protest the movie. I protested
them being made.
Stage production. And the stage production I did not like. I was straightforward about
it. So you're straightforward about it. Mm-hmm. All right, well, you missed a good performance, but you liked it.
Yeah.
All right, now, one more thing. Did you see, I had put it up on my personal Facebook page,
mm-hmm.
And because I just thought it was kind of life is like science fiction, they have synthetic urine now. They sell it just right in the store.
Wait, hold it.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Synthetic
Why
urine.
Why
does anybody want to buy?
Well, I guess to pass a drug test.
Urine.
To pass drug a test. Drug test. But that's what the bizarre part is. Like, well, wait a minute. How come they don't know?
Right. You know? Right. I mean,
how come they don't know?
It should show up as sample 77.
That's what I'm saying, but I guess. Now, but then, here's the thing. If it's synthetic urine,
yes,
and it's convincing because it's got, you know, Charles, because I put it up and Charles was like, well, if it's got urea in it. All right. If it's got urea in it, then it's urine. So how is it synthetic? I don't understand. And then the best part, though, on the box, it says no mixing.
What? This is straight up?
No mixing.
Straight no chaser.
That's right. No mixing.
No cocktail for this.
That's right.
Oh, my
gosh. So, synthetic urine. They sell it at the store, at a local bodega near you. Or a bodega or a head shop. They have it.
Got to be a head shop.
Brian, I see you have a friend there. Brian's
yes,
got a new friend.
I've got a friend.
It's Fernando.
Fernando, you want to say something to the people at home? Say something. Go ahead, Fernando. Go. Do it.
Mike, you're so sexy. Cool. I think you're sexy.
All right, well, Fernando's not talking right now. But if I run out the room, Fernando will start talking. Anyway, so we're going to go to the interview with Gina Prince-Blythewood. Now, I have to say, Beyond the Lights is a very good film. It's both a love story, but it's also a cautionary tale about the music industry. And like I said, what's the cost, you know, of fame and success, especially in the music business. And Gina and I go back a long way because she and her husband, Reggie Rock Blythewood, we were judges at Acapulco Black Film Festival back in the day. Yes,
yeah.
This is the year after I was there as a filmmaker. I came back as a judge. And so we hung out. I saw pictures. I'm going to put them up on my Facebook page. Pictures of us then. You know, and and then I have a picture of us today. But she's continued to make really good films, She did Disappearing Acts as well. I don't know if you saw that one, adapted from the novel. And this film, you know, Nate Parker, who is kind of an up-and-coming actor. You've seen him before. He kind of reminds you like a young Denzel. He was in Red Tails. Do you know who he is?
Yeah.
Did you see Red Tails, Selena?
No, I didn't.
All right. At least she's being honest. No, I didn't. I hated it. It was a piece of crap. Oh, well, no, I didn't see it. But anyway, but it's a really good film, well acted. There are a number of things that will happen that you don't expect, and it really maintains just a level of strong narrative and good characterization that you hope you would get in a film. So I liked it. So I got a chance to talk to her. She had some really interesting things to say. I played a soundbite in the beginning of the show of her answering, of course, the famous question. So Gina Prince Blythewood, director of Beyond the Lights, which opens this Friday.
She tells a good love story.
Yes, she does.
You know, I mean, with the picture of Love and Basketball with Omar Epps and Sanaa Lathan.
Yes.
Very good. Very
yes,
well
yes,
done.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. All right, so Gina Prince Blythewood.
What is this film about to you? What does this mean to you, this film, making this film?
Yeah, this film was very important to me. It was a story that's been locked in my head for many, many years. And it's really about a young woman who's pushed into a highly sexualized persona to get ahead in the music industry. And it works. She becomes very successful, but at what cost? And the film is really about that cost to her soul, to put yourself out there as something inauthentic for success, and how hard it is to pull back from that once you've achieved that success. And it's something I think we see in the music industry over and over again. It's almost like there's a script for young singers to follow, and it works. But the problem is the envelope keeps getting pushed further and further, and there's really nowhere else to go but off a cliff, really.
I agree with you. How much could you relate to this character? And over time, if you had this idea, how did it sort of change and develop?
It's interesting. It started from a personal place as a writer, just envisioning not having a voice, which I don't think there can be anything worse than not having a say in your own life. And for me as a writer, and having this thing trapped, that's what it felt like. It just felt trapped. But in addition, there was an issue that happened in my own life in terms of being, I was adopted and searched for my birth mother and found her. And, you know, as an adoptee, you have this fantasy of it's going to be this amazing running to each other's arms and whole thing. And it wasn't that at all. It was pretty troubling and learning the circumstances of how I came into the world was pretty tough, and realized that if this woman had kept me, I would have grown up in a home where I was loved and hated. And I just thought that was a really interesting character to deal with, somebody who didn't grow up with unconditional love. And as a writer, the great thing is that you can use it as therapy. So I was able to put that personal thing into this character and then put her into this world of music, hip-hop and R&B that I really wanted to explore.
Well, you actually kind of slightly answered the question I was going to ask you. Was writing this somewhat cathartic for you and then finally getting it made now at this precipice?
Yeah, it's, again, when you... I mean, this film, it was so clear in my head what this film was and the importance of it, given what is going on with girls and women and even boys and young men today. And to have it trapped inside of me for so long and the project almost going and then dying over and over again, I was a miserable person for a couple of years. So to be at this point now where the film is about to come out and audiences are responding to it, it really is surreal to see how far I came and how many no's we had to overcome.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I went to see the film on, I think it was Monday, and sitting behind me was Malcolm Lee. So it was kind of like, and then I'm seeing you this week. And it was just a few of us, but we were all completely into it.
Okay.
So when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
I have been writing stories since I was a little girl. It's funny, too, because my parents came down for the premiere of Love and Basketball, and they brought this short story I wrote when I was 9 years old. They had saved it, and to read that and see that little story, it was actually about a turkey on Thanksgiving who pretended they were a pig so they wouldn't be eaten. So the fact that they saved that and recognized and always encouraged that in me. And as I got older, I thought I wanted to write for soap operas. I used to watch five a day, and I heard how much money they make as well. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I got into college at UCLA that my aspirations got a little bigger and saw film as a really great way to tell stories, because the format is so big. You go in the theater, it's dark, you're totally enveloped, and you really enter a new world. I always thought that was really cool.
And why do you think we as human beings need to tell each other stories?
Wow. Honestly, I feel film can change you. A great film can change you. It can change your thinking. It could change who you are. It can change the conversation, which is what I'm hoping for this film. And it's just important to be able to put yourself into other people's shoes. And again, I love to go to a great film and lose myself in it and discover new worlds, new people, new ways of life. I think it's important because it brings us, film has the ability to bring us together.
True. And in your estimation, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
Wow. What makes a good... That is a tough question. Honestly, I mean, a good story is one that if I'm listening to it, I want to know what happens next. I think it's as simple as that.
Okay. Now, you and Reggie are one of the few Black, husband and wife filmmaking teams, mm-hmm. and he produces film with you. How often do you two get to work together?
Yeah, the funny thing is Reggie and I have been working on each other's stuff from the beginning, and we've only taken producer credits. I took one on Biker Boys, and this is the first time he's taking it on one of my projects, but we've been doing it forever, and our scripts have to get past each other before they even go out in the world. We're the toughest on each other. And it's a blessing to be on set, because it is so tough directing. I love it, but it's very tough, and you're fighting about everything, and the fact that I have somebody I know on set that has my back, that only cares about the film and about me, is such a comfort. And my hope is that, when he directs his next film, that I can do that for him as well.
I sort of believe a film is directed three times.
Mm-hmm.
First time when you write it, you're directing in your head.
Right.
Second time you're on set, you're getting what you can. Then in editing, you can literally craft a new film.
Yeah.
So, A, do you agree with that? And B, what is your favorite part, and what do you get out of each?
Yeah, absolutely. You are 100% correct. And I don't think enough people understand that. But foremost, it starts with the script. You cannot make a good movie from a bad script. And for me, the script stage is what takes the longest. I take a couple years to write a script. This last one, Beyond the Lights, said 55 drafts. So, yeah, I write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. But it is kind of amazing, because you are seeing the film in your head. Shooting is my favorite part. It is so immediate. There's so much adrenaline. You're just creating, and you're chasing that perfect take. And it's so collaborative. Everyone's working together for a common thing. But I love working with actors and dope actors. So it's just fun. Post, I hate. And I feel so bad for my editor, Terry Shropshire, who's done three films now with me. It's so hard for me, because those first couple weeks, all you see is what you didn't get. And I think I'm a failure, and I think I made a terrible film. And she has to put up with me for the first couple weeks, just curled up in a ball, miserable. But once you start shaping it and it comes together, it can be exciting. But it is the toughest part for me, is post.
And we're back.
No.
Hey, look, Byron, you're so cute there with Fernanda sitting in your lap.
It's a very lovely picture.
Like, I think Fernando is
Mike
cheating.
And I want to hold hands just watching our two children.
I think Fernando's cheating on you there with Byron. Mm. Hello, Fernando. At some point, Fernando may talk. So, the next film that I'm going to play an interview with now, you ever see these movies, Harold and Kumar? You ever see those movies?
I've seen movies of that genre, but I haven't seen that particular one.
Well, there's one of the actors. His name is Cal Penn. He's an interesting actor because he's, you know, a big actor who took time off from being an actor to be an activist and to campaign for Obama. Yeah. And so he's really interesting. And then he became a UN ambassador. Yes, and he's going back to acting. So, there's a film that comes out, or actually just came out this past Friday, called Bhopal, A Prayer for Rain. And it's about the disaster in Bhopal that happened. It's so devastating to see this movie, to see what happened and how so little was done about it, how many people were affected, how many people died, how many innocent victims there were for this industrial accident that clearly could have been avoided.
Yeah.
You know, because the director did a lot of research as to how this all went down. The film also stars Martin Sheen and Misha Barton. I picture me, Misha Barton, too. Misha Barton and Martin Sheen, I'll put it up on my Facebook. But
of course you will.
I remember the Bhopal.
You remember that.
And the fact that what I remember most about it is that DuPont refused to pay for its part in the disaster.
Yes.
And it really
to this day.
To this day, that's right. I remember.
And then when they did have some remuneration, some really pittance.
It was
a pittance. So it's a really powerful film, surprisingly powerful. And again, it was made by someone from that region. The director is Indian and, you know, grew up in that area and knows and has, is very close to the story. So it's really much, I think, I don't think an American filmmaker would have done... It wouldn't have had the same heart and the same feeling, because it's very... You really are moved when you see what happens, and you're also angry, you know? It's a movie that I think will make you angry. But I really recommend it. But Cal Penn's really interesting to interview, because he's funny, but he's very smart and has a really interesting career and a really interesting head on his shoulders. So... This is an interview with Cal Penn, also yes. known as Kumar, for Bhopal, A Prayer for Rain. Yes.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm talking with Cal Penn, actor and producer, and one of the stars of the new film, Bhopal, A Prayer for Rain. Cal, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
When did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
Good question, and interesting that you called it storytelling. That's how I always refer to it.
Okay.
Probably in eighth grade, I would say. I really, you know, I was one of those kids that really enjoyed acting, and enjoyed it because it was kind of the type of thing that it seemed like, you know, whenever I would watch movies or whenever I would watch people watch movies, it was the type of thing that suspension of disbelief, the ability to make somebody laugh or cry or really meet people on a screen that you might never get to meet in real life or experience circumstances that you would never get to experience. There was a certain magic to that I really liked that seemed really powerful, for lack of a better word, emotionally powerful. And I thought, you know, I kind of want to be part of something like that.
Why do you think human beings need to tell stories? It's in every culture.
It is in every culture. I think part of it is probably just our need to learn from the past or hold on to the past, and then also think about the future, plan for the future. And then there are just certain shared experiences, right? I think on the base level, everybody loves to laugh. Certain things I think are innate, like the ability to love each other or things like friendship. You know, along the same lines, I'm always fascinated by, you know, food. In every culture, food is shared. People sit down for a meal together. They don't always talk. But that act of sharing food, there's something about that, too, that I think is fascinating.
In your estimation, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
That's a good question. What makes a good story and a story worth telling? Are we assuming that they're both the same?
No, not always.
Or is a story worth telling? I think...
Or both. Pretty much the same, I guess, hopefully.
Well, yeah, I guess they are the same, aren't they? A good story or a story worth telling, I think it's something that makes you feel an emotion that you didn't necessarily feel before you were exposed to that story, is proof that it's one worth telling. The reason that I say that is, I'm struggling for an example right now, but I know that, you know, there are so many times where you watch a movie and it makes you angry.
Sure.
And you, at least I find myself doing this, I mistake that anger for something bad. Well, that movie was terrible, but then I won't stop talking about how angry I am.
Right, right.
The character did, right? Well, obviously, if I'm that angry about it, I must have been pretty invested in it. And if I was that invested in it, it must have been pretty good.
Well, I tend to agree with that. Like, it got a reaction out of you.
Yeah, it was emotionally manipulative, maybe, but that meant that it was good. It did something.
So you think a good story is a story that will reach you and make you have some kind of feeling?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I could go with that. Well, now, listening to you talk and having looked at your career, I've kind of been fascinated by, you know, the fact that you did comedy and then you're, you know, a government official. Why do you think it is that comedic actors can make the transition to drama and go on and win Oscars in the case of a number of actors, whereas a straight actor, it's not so easy to make the transition to comedy?
Is that true?
Well, look at all the examples. There are only a few of the greats who can go back and forth, like a De Niro or a Nicholson. But there are a lot of actors, like a Tom Hanks or a Jackie Gleason, or there are tons of actors who Robin Williams who are comedic actors, but then they can make that transition, or Bill Murray to drama and do it so well they'll win awards.
That's a good question. I don't know. It's funny you say that, because I'm always very self-conscious of that. Like, I've always had a hard time. One of the more challenging things for me to do is a sitcom.
Yeah.
Because sitcom timing is so specific, and it's a strange kind of art form. There's a rhythm to it that isn't natural but is funny. And I've always had trouble doing that, and I've always loved it because of the challenge. I've always loved the challenge of trying to do it, but I'm always super self-conscious when I go on an audition for a sitcom or something. So I don't know, but I've never known why that was. There's just something about the, excuse me, I don't have a cough button. And there's something about that rhythm or cadence or I don't know.
Huh.
What have other people said? Have you asked people?
Oh, I have. I've heard some. Well, I heard the best answer I ever heard was somebody said, well, anybody who can make you laugh can make you cry. And I thought, that's a pretty...
Why? Your question is why?
It is why. And I mean, people felt that comedy takes more bravery and that an actor who does comedy in many ways is not as inhibited as when it comes to drama, they're more willing to show themselves.
Okay.
So I've heard some interesting answers on that. But, well, let me ask you now a little bit about Motwani, because I've been told it was loosely based on Raj Kumar Kaswani, but not really. So how did you approach this, knowing that it was based in some ways on a real-life person, but you still had to make it your own and have this character arc he has?
Yeah, so I asked the writer, the guy who wrote and directed Bhopal is a guy named Ravi Kumar. You met him. You met Ravi.
Yeah, I loved him. He was great.
Yeah, really cool guy.
Really cool guy, yes.
Sort of straight up. I'm like, hey, now that we're moving forward with this movie, should I go to Bhopal? Should I meet this guy? Should I spend like 2 weeks with him and see what makes him tick? And he said no, because, you know, something like 70 or 80% of Motwani, my character, is you know, fictionalized. So instead of making him exactly what this Kaswani guy was like, what Ravi wanted me to do was sort of, you know, figure out where this adaptation comes from. And in the case of this character, what I love that he did with it was, you know, he starts out really broad. I think my character's introduced on a moped with a ridiculous 1970s-esque shirt. I play a tabloid journalist. And so you get the idea right away that this is a guy that doesn't particularly care for the people around him. He just wants to sell newspapers at any cost. So any ridiculous headline that he puts on the cover, people are going to buy. And over the course of the film, you realize that he actually cares very deeply for his town, and he tries to warn people that there's this impending industrial disaster. Nobody listens to him because he's you know, made up too many lies in the past. So it's sort of your classic boy who cried wolf kind of tale. And I thought that it was an interesting thing to prepare, because to have 20% based on a real person and to look at archives and photos and realize, you know, to what extent was this guy, you know, really trying to help these people, versus the embellished version of the movie, and particularly a movie that, you know, is that dark. It was a layer that, on the one hand, luckily, I could rely on Ravi for pretty intimately, since he created the character. On the flip side, I really wanted to go and meet this journalist, but I understand in retrospect why I was discouraged from doing that. But I'm hoping to actually meet him during they're doing a I think the Indian premiere is actually in Bhopal, so hopefully.
Oh wow, that's great.
Sit down with them, yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting, considering our conversation and looking at your career in a way, you know, some of your career arc is doing that, where people knew you from comedy, but now it seems that you're doing more dramatic roles. And that's just one of those things, you know, to be taken seriously when people perceive you a certain way, that's not an easy thing to pull off either in a script or in playing a character. What was the biggest challenge for you, perhaps, besides learning Hindi?
Learning Hindi was actually a big challenge. I didn't know that you know, most of my lines were going to be in Hindi until I got to India. So here I was in LA preparing. You know, the script was in English, everything was in English. We go to the first rehearsal when we're in India, and I read the first scene in English, and the director kind of looks at me and goes, "Great, now do it again in Hindi." And I was like, "I don't speak that language, so what are we going to do?" And he's like, "I thought you do." I'm like, "No, I speak Gujarati," which is a similar language. The comparison I would make is it's sort of like Portuguese and Spanish or
okay. In
Hindi. So, you know, if you speak Portuguese, you don't necessarily speak fluent Spanish. And so we started this really quick process of trying to, you know, we hired a dialect coach, and I learned the lines that I needed to learn, and the Indian actors were really supportive also. But it wasn't just speaking, you know, it was kind of the actor's nightmare of realizing, okay, I know all my lines, I just know them in the wrong language.
So
learning them in the right language and then realizing, you know, just like English, you know, I want to make sure I don't have an American accent when I'm speaking Hindi, have the right kind of accent for the right time period in the right place. So that was probably the biggest challenge. I think the second one would probably be just the, you know, shooting in India is a very different experience, and I loved it, and it took a couple of weeks to get used to, I think, because the way of doing business there is very different. You've got actors who are, and I'm in awe of this still, you know, actors there shoot multiple projects at the same time. And here, when you say you're doing that, that means, okay, I'm doing the movie for, you know, this movie for the next 3 weeks, and then I'm doing another movie for the next 2 months, and then I have a break for a week, and then I'm doing another movie for a month. There, when they say they're doing movies back-to-back or simultaneously, that means that on Monday they're shooting one movie, on Tuesday they're shooting a second movie, on Wednesday they might come back to do some scenes from the first movie, and then spend the second half of the day on the third movie. Like, I don't understand how this works, and it's chaos. Like, sometimes you'll have actors not show up on time, not because they're lazy, but because they're shooting another movie.
Wow.
Like, the sheer insurance that has to happen for an American movie to get made, like, they would just never let you do that. So at first, an environment like that was really, you know, it was a little stressful, but then you realize there's this whole separate, vibrant film scene that exists because of that, and it was actually awesome. So what started out as kind of a challenge and trying to wrap my head around it, you know, by the second week, you're kind of thinking, this is actually amazing that these actors can go from one role to another, you know, sometimes in the same day. We had a really global crew, you know, our directors from the UK, three of us, myself, Misha Barton, and Martin Sheen are from the US. There were all these Indian actors. The director of photography was German. So, you know, what started out as maybe communication challenges turned very quickly into realizing this is a really cool opportunity to work with people from all over the world.
Wow, that's pretty fantastic. And you're right. I the only time I've ever heard of such a thing is Michael J. Fox when he worked on Back to the Future. You know, he had to work on his show during the day and then work on Back to the Future at
right.
night.
I forgot about that.
Yeah,
that's such a crazy story.
Yeah, wow. So now, I'm just also curious now, besides, you know, all the things that you had to do for this movie, how much did you really know about this disaster? And was it the script, the content, all the elements? What really made you want to do this part?
I knew somewhat about the disaster. So I remember, you know, I was a little kid when it happened, but I do have some sort of vague memories of it being in the news. But I think more importantly, you know, hearing from parents about it, excuse me, and then also I had a development studies class in college where we took sort of a deep dive into Union Carbide and Dow Chemical and the whole disaster. But I would say I didn't really research it in depth since then until it was time to make the movie. And even then, I think because my character, unlike, you know, Martin's character is based on an actual person who's still alive and who had a pretty pivotal role in the whole thing. Since mine was kind of a fictionalized adaptation, I relied a lot on the writer. So Ravi grew up not too far from Bhopal. My biggest concern, I think, in making it was I wanted to make sure that, you know, if you're doing something that's, it's not quite a biopic, but it's, you know, it's based on real events. You know, 16,000 people were killed by this company, and a lot of these people who still live in this community are affected. The site's never been cleaned up by Dow Chemical. So my biggest concern was, you know, you do a movie, and yes, it's fictitious, but you want to make sure that you're at least doing justice to the stories of the people who were actually affected by it. And you're
sure,
you know, you're not turning it, excuse me, you're not turning it into something that's just this outrageous embellishment. So even though I didn't know as much as I do now, having worked through it, I was glad to learn what I did, and I was even more glad to know that the director's primary concern was, you know, telling a story in a respectful way.
Well, I have to say, I was very, very moved.
Can I have one more question? I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. Then my last question is, I tend to believe that, you know, as you define your art defines you. What did you learn about yourself in the process of making this film?
I think I've learned... Selfishly, I learned that I should take more risks like this in terms of language. Mm. So when I found out that the character was speaking mostly Hindi, I mean, the first thing that I said to the director is, do you want me to go back to America, and do you want to hire an Indian actor? And he looked at me like I was crazy, and he said, no, are you not up to the challenge? And I just kind of thought, ooh, what a thing to say to an actor. Of course I'm up for the challenge.
Right.
Like, if you're going to call me out on that, of course I'm going to say, yes, I'm up for it. And so I think I, you know, there's that thing that flips in your head where I think the thing that I learned the most selfishly was I'm so glad that I went through that challenge and that hopefully I pulled it off. I mean, until the movie opens in India, I guess I won't know for sure if I totally butchered it or if I did a good job. But that was sort of the first thing. And then the second thing was, I learned that, I guess, you know, what I thought everybody knew, I thought this was a movie that everybody knew the ending to, just because I had known about the story before. But we screened the movie in New York, and I learned that there are people coming out of the theater who said that they were angry.
Yes.
They didn't know that this had actually happened, or they were angry because, you know, this happened 30 years ago, but the disaster happened, you know, just a couple of years ago. So they concerned with, you know, why do industrial accidents keep happening? Are they really accidents? What can we do to stop them? And kind of learned the power, I guess, of, you know, going back to that first conversation you and I had about storytelling,
mm-hmm.
going back to the power of a story like this to change people's opinions or to make them think about, you know, these are stories that we don't read about in the New York Times or in the Huffington Post, because maybe they don't, you know, they're not as sexy anymore, for lack of a better word. They're not as salacious as maybe the current climate wants them to be, but they're still stories that affect tens of thousands of people, and they're no longer just Indian stories or corporate stories. They're sort of these human stories. And I loved that about the reaction. You know, it's such a tragic thing that happened, but if something good can come out of it, I guess I sort of learned that it's a great way to tell a story, and hopefully can yield some positive results for people.
Well, it's been great talking with you, and I'm sorry I didn't get to talk to you at the party. I was at the event with you and Martin and Misha and everybody before, but I hope I get to talk to you again. Thanks a lot,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, same here. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Bye. Bye.
And we're back.
Oh, my goodness. Night Shift.
Yippee.
It's my favorite show.
Hello.
All right. Oh, yeah. All right.
So, okay. I'll tell you what the next movie's about, but I feel Byron's probably going to want to say something. This other movie's called The Better Angels. Do you know anything about this film?
No.
Okay. The Better Angels is an interesting film because it is about the boy Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln as a boy, him growing up in Indiana. Yes. I don't know if you know, he grew up very, very, very poor,
yes,
in the rural parts of Indiana. And I don't know if you know that they had what they called in the milk sickness, where the sickness that is like a blight. And the cows ate the diseased grass and then passed it on to human beings. And a lot of, thousands and thousands of people died. Lincoln lost his mom. Mm-hmm. To this disease, and then there was a transition, and his dad got remarried. So it's shot in black and white, and it's got very little dialogue. And this director, A.J. Edwards, is a protege of Terrence Malick. Now, if you know who Terrence Malick is, he did, back in the day, he did Badlands and he really did like two iconic films and didn't work for like 23 years.
Right.
Of late, he did To the Wonder and Tree of Life and Thin Red Line and, a few other films. And this guy was an editor, worked with him, a second unit director. And it really feels like a Terrence Malick film when you see it. But it's just a way of storytelling where very little dialogue. It's all told in pictures. And it's shot in black and white. And it's got a documentary feel, so you kind of feel like
You're in it,
and it's in the 1800s. But what's really interesting is just what life was like in America back then. It's not something you see on film very often.
We glamorize
a lot of that
period.
Now, did you see, by the way, did you see Spielberg's Lincoln? What did you think of that movie?
Loved it.
You loved it?
Yes. I thought it was, the power of it was that it really was as reflective of the 1860s, it was even more about what's going on right now in the Congress. This is the insanity that's there. Oh, they're playing it out to the letter right now, 2014. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the movie. It's very well done, and I thought Sally Field's performance was
Sally
brilliant.
Field was great.
Brilliant.
I like Tommy Lee Jones, too.
Oh, that last scene, there are three scenes in that movie that are just, I believe, are some of the best filmmaking I've seen. That last scene with Tommy Lee Jones, and he's in bed with his wife, and you're given a reveal. The reveal. Mm-hmm.
I'll give it away for those.
Okay, I won't do that.
Then
the other scene that I thought was just amazing was that scene where she breaks down and gives Abe his everything because she paid the price. She paid a heavy price for it. Standing with
next
him.
To him.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you see the movie, Elena?
No.
Okay.
Oh, this is one of those movies.
Like, Elena's like, yes, she should win an Oscar for that scene. It was brilliant. It's amazing. Best acting I ever seen. All right. No, I never
and
saw.
Then,
it.
Of course, in the opening, right in the opening, where you had the black soldiers and the white soldiers, the two white soldiers who were there at Gettysburg and never can't remember the Gettysburg Address, and the black soldier says it for him. But it's a defining moment of this film because
right.
that was the only time you saw really an interaction of African Americans in that film. Because all the other times it was from a perspective of Tommy Lee Jones as head of the Congress,
right.
and from Abe Lincoln as President of the United States. And it was like it was their movie, but it's a very good movie.
You liked it.
Yeah.
That I'd say Byron liked it. So you didn't see Lincoln? Did you see Abraham Lincoln? Did you see Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter? Did you see that one?
No.
That was very good, too. That was even better.
I thought about it.
That was very good.
The thing about
that was a great movie.
Funny.
I love
it. When you consider the creative notion that they were putting up on that screen,
yep.
why not? It
That's
makes
right.
as good a sense as
exactly.
any.
Exactly. They were evil.
Yes,
they
exactly.
were vampires.
They were vampires, right?
Why not delve into that?
So you didn't see that one either, Elena?
No.
Do you want to?
Sure.
Okay, you should.
Well, unless it's really scary.
No, it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
It's funny, right?
It's fun. It was great in 3D. Yeah. There's a sequence where he's like riding horses. They're chasing each other, running on horses, running on top of horses. Remember that? Pretty great sequence. This movie is nothing like that.
Okay.
It's nothing like Lincoln, and it's nothing like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter either. It's called what?
So your point has been?
Well, we were just talking about Lincoln movies. Lincoln movies of late. Okay. And this is a recent Lincoln movie because this is called The Better Angels. It's about it's a period in Lincoln's life I knew very little about, and I think most people know very little about. And it's very well done. Fascinating film. Very good acting. It's definitely a lesson in film, telling a story in pictures. Let's just put it like that.
Okay.
So, A.J. Edwards for The Better Angels, which is currently in theaters.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm speaking with writer-director A.J. Edwards. A.J., welcome to WBAI.
Thank you for having me. Hi there.
Why do you think we as human beings need to tell stories to each other? What do you think the importance of stories are?
Boy, that's quite a fundamental question. I guess there can be a number of reasons in the beginning, which were passing on tradition and wisdom, or it could be something as superficial as entertainment, just a pastime. But, it definitely is innate and necessary, and... with this one, I think it was with the Better Angels, it was to show the an unknown chapter in a great man's life, someone who's completely familiar to us, someone that we think we know inside and out, being Abraham Lincoln. Yet there's this part of him that was unrevealed. It was something he spoke about little, and the attraction was there to chronicle something that otherwise hadn't been put on film before, which was his time in Indiana.
Well, one of the things I found interesting about the film is that it's a little known part of his history, but it shows things that shaped him to be the Lincoln we knew him to be, but at the same time it shows parts of this country and how it was shaped to be the country we know it to be. Were some of those parallels conscious, or am I just reading into it?
No, that's definitely the case. Hopefully the picture does act like a mirror in that regard, and that it's a universal story, one that we can see ourselves in and where we are today. Yeah, the era that it shows is not often put on film, and also the people in the story, these are illiterate backwoods farmers in early 19th century Indiana. It's a new state just put into the Union. I think it's the 18th, and it's a free state, one that is put on the map without slaves. And so these were people that weren't having their painting, their portraits painted, and they weren't being written about. They were just living an agrarian life and trying to get by. And little did the Lincoln family know, they had this gift of a child, this kind of miracle boy who would grow up to work wonders.
From what I understand, it was originally something that Terrence Malick wanted to do himself. Tell me what drew you to the project specifically, and how it ended up falling into your hands to direct.
Sure. I don't know if Malick was ever actually going to direct it himself. He had it kind of as a series of notes. There was nothing other than a couple pages of scraps, scraps of notes that get put together. And I had told him coincidentally that I had a Lincoln film that I wanted to make, and this was back in about 2007. And then he revealed to me that he had a couple Lincoln ideas about this specific chapter, the Indiana years. And the idea that I had in mind was larger. Being young and naive, I had a more impractical approach, and he was kind enough to show me his thoughts and his angle and approach to the film, and how it was narrower than what I had imagined. And that was essential to the growth of the project, to narrow the focus and make the aim of the story the transition between Lincoln's two mothers. He loses his beloved biological mother Nancy, and it's about this transitional time of him coming to love and accept his stepmother. That was the seed of the film and what he imparted to me, and what made it a reality was that terrific focused angle.
What were some of the things that you thought were most important to bring out in the story, most important to show?
The notion of this young boy who grew up in poverty, really without education and had uneducated parents, and in the deepest of grief, sorrow, and misery after losing his mother and lots of his family to sickness, he decides to take it upon himself to educate himself, to advance himself, and doing so eventually improves the entire country based upon his own responsibility, discipline, and so on. If I were to say, what do I hope people take away, it would really be that. All that's good in America and all the potential and opportunities that we have is really encapsulated in the story. It's all there and depicted in the story of this young, naive boy who's unaware of the incredible destiny that awaits.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your stylistic approach. The phrase, picture tells a thousand words, I think is very apt here because the script is very, very minimal. There's very little dialogue, very little narration, but it's the images that really tell the story. People have likened it to Malick, but I just think it's a way of telling a story. I found it to be very similar in some ways, but very, very different. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Sure. Some pictures and directors that I was inspired by were the Indian filmmaker Satyajit Ray and his Apu trilogy.
Oh, yeah.
If there's really a parallel film, it would really be that one. His Padmapanchali, where there's depiction of poverty, the children struggling through it, experiencing death for the first time, and that being a rite of passage for them. How the siblings are brought closer during that time of grief. Stylistically, the film was conceived in black and white. That was how I had imagined it from the start. I think that was to provide austerity and starkness to the story because, you know, when you're dealing with the coonskin caps, the muskets, the Lincoln log cabin, there was a possibility it could have ended up being like Disneyland, a Frontierland sort of feeling, and that had to be removed from the start. And then with the jump cuts and the very mobile camera, the idea behind that was to really have it be more like a documentary, where you're not dealing in traditional film coverage and shot reverse shot, but as if a camera and a crew had been dropped in 1817 on this homestead and had one chance to capture life on the wing. And so that's why it has, I think, the sort of restless, quick feeling that it does.
Because you know what he will become, in some ways you're sort of on the edge of your seat. You're just waiting for things to kind of be markers to let you know some inkling of the man he's going to become. Again, does that make sense to you?
Well, definitely, and I think that's of the power of just the concept of the film, which is already so front-loaded. People going into this film already know so much, like when you know, almost like Titanic or something, where...
Right.
The structure of the film is so intact, the end has already been written, and so it's really, really just about having it be sincere and direct, the emotions being honest, making sure that this story of the parents and their child is one that connects and radiates throughout the audience.
Do you storyboard in advance? How planned is what you shot, and how much of it becomes what happens there on set?
There was no storyboarding. Because we didn't do the typical coverage, it really was more about being like a documentary crew and being there to capture rather than to create. We weren't there to set up and block out shots and create an artificial moment. We were there to capture spontaneity and life as it happened based on the actor's interpretation of the screenplay. So the screenplay was really a blueprint on which to build something greater. Here are the lines, here's the beats that we're looking for. But how you get from A to C, your decision, and the amount of time it takes to play that out. The camera was often trying to keep up rather than the actors really working for the camera. You know, it was vice versa.
How important was it for you to bring us in and then just keep that sense of we don't know what's going to happen? There's no traditional structure. You're waiting for the end of Act 1 or 2.
Yeah, I think although the structure is a little unusual. Hopefully, it is classical and advances in a grounded way. And as far as the surprises go, there certainly are those in the tribulations that he faces. You know, the terrifying milk stick that kills his mother and neighbors and aunt and uncle. You know, the arrival of his stepmother and the fact that his father spontaneously leaves them during a very, very harsh winter, which to a modern parent is horrible.
Right. Right.
So the surprises are definitely there. And it was a very harsh time. Hopefully that comes across, you know, the bitterness of the cold, the lack of food. When Sarah Lincoln, his stepmother, arrived, her description upon seeing Abe and his sister when he was 10 years older, she said they hardly looked human.
Now, how long did you shoot for?
It was a quick shoot. We just shot for about 21 days.
Wow.
Yeah, it was fast. We shot in upstate New York at the Mohonk Mountain Preserve in Kerhonkson. They were terrific there and had the hardwood stands that we were looking for and high canopies. And but it was definitely fast.
How long did this take to edit?
The editing was about 8 or 9 months, and that's very important to me. Post-production is where I'm happiest, and I love cutting and working with music and sound and so on. Yeah, the shoots can be quick, but reserving time for post is necessary.
And I believe a film is actually directed three times. The first time when you're writing it and developing it, you're kind of directing in your head. Second time when you're on set, you're getting what you can. And the third time, you're actually directing in many ways in the editing room. So my question is, A, do you agree with that? And I guess you've already answered, so I was going to ask, what's your favorite and what do you get out of each stage?
Yeah, you just described it perfectly. My favorite definitely is post. It's also fun, obviously, when you're developing and writing, infinite possibility and you're free. But within that freedom, you have to assert a certain amount of practicality, or else you're writing in vain, because what you're thinking is not producible. Because when you're writing, you have to think, will this attract actors that will get the movie financed? Or will this number of locations really be possible within a 3-week shoot? And so on. So it's important to be realistic. When you're on set and shooting, to me, it's a whirlwind. I even forget a lot of it. It's all so fast and happening, and there's so many moving parts. And then when you can settle down with the material, and it's almost like thinking about it, seeing it for the first time on the edit, and then you just get it refined, and you keep ironing out the wrinkles until hopefully something smooth and visible is there.
When you edit, do you have a temp track? Do you edit in silence? How do you put together your picture and then decide, or start your spotting?
Anytime I'm editing anything, my hope is that there's a internal integrity already in the material without music,
right?
Without spiced up sound. Hopefully there is a core and a heart there that can move in itself, just in the behavior and expressiveness of the actors, the authenticity and so on. Yeah, when music is used well, it can completely transform everything in a magical way. And I think about music from the start, writing or even before then. Music is what I most enjoy working with in film. Yeah, here there's the music of Armenian-American composer Hovhannes. There's Copland. Kalinnikov provides kind of the theme of the film, the 19th century Russian composer who's young. And then the original music is provided by Hannon Townsend out of Austin.
What did you learn about yourself in the process of making this film?
Boy, that's a good question. I think that this story presents the notion of family at its center, and education. I think that it confirmed for me their incredible value, and in how the unbreakable bond that we share will last forever, and that we're being shaped always by forces in our lives that are beyond our control, and even things that we think are banal or everyday, be it sitting in class with a fourth grade teacher, or maybe an uncle who you spend time with, that these are actually moments and people that are part of your fate, and that just as you change yourself and improve yourself or make mistakes, other people are shaping you as well, for better or for worse. I'll suggest these better angels of our nature, to truly believe that and live in such a way, I guess, would be what I learned, and hopefully I guess we'll continue to learn.
In your estimation, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
Gosh, what a question. I would have to say one that connects you with the artist that's telling it. There's no point speaking into a vacuum or being so esoteric or eclectic to where there's a fall off and a disconnect between you and some kind of audience. The audience doesn't have to be large, and I'm not saying you need to compromise your vision or sell out in any way, but it does need to have a universal enough amount of humanity that it reaches people in a sincere way. Whether it's two people or a million, doesn't matter, but it does need to have a reach to it.
What's next for you?
I'm preparing a picture to shoot in the spring of next year in Texas. It's a modern-day redemption story in the vein of Crime and Punishment, themes and characters of that story. We'll be right back.
Okay. So we got two more for tonight. Two more interviews. One is going to be with Jean-Yves Olivier for... and he's actually the subject of a documentary called A Plot for Peace. Did you hear about this movie, Byron?
Kind of.
It's a documentary about a man who was a French businessman who really was the architect for not only helping end apartheid, okay, and getting Mandela out in the process, but really changing a number of nations that were in conflict at the time, and the release of many prisoners of war and whatnot. It's a really fascinating movie, and he's a very shrewd businessman, but also humanitarian, you know, on a level that you really don't see. And then finally, there's a movie that I have to say, this blew me away. This movie now is not currently in theaters, but it's playing around the country, and so you should look for it. It'll be out on DVD soon enough. It's traveling the country now. It's playing in D.C. It'll be coming back to New York, but like upstate. It's a movie called Bitter Honey.
Okay.
Now, I'm just going to read you a little of the synopsis of that. We'll get to that. It'll be at the end. But let's just say it's about polygamy. And it's polygamy in this country that I'll tell you all about it after before I play the interview. But anyway, fascinating, disturbing, like you're just in shock when you watch it, or at least I was, because I had no idea that there was modern polygamy going on and the way it goes on and these women and the situation.
In Utah, it's still going on.
No, I'm not even talking about it. That's
a different
level.
You're saying way and beyond.
This is way beyond that.
Okay. I mean, that's, Mormons and multiple wives and all that. That's a whole other thing. Big love. This is big, way beyond big love.
Bigger love. Large love.
This is. Great. Anyway, so, but yes, so I have an interview with Jean-Yves Olivier. And I also wanted to ask you a question, Alina.
Yes.
How do you feel, being the Republican that you are, that the Republicans now have taken the Senate? Now, as a Republican, what are you looking forward to seeing happen?
Well, to reiterate, in the past, I've said that I'm not necessarily, would not...
You don't agree with all the
I'll agree all
agree. Yeah, all. Right. But...
And would I vote against or vote for, independent or a Democratic platform? Yes.
You haven't, because you voted against Obama and you voted for Bush. So, you know, for the most part, you've been... That's the party that you prefer. So... Looking at whatever the positive parts are of that party, I'm curious what you hope or what you optimistically see could happen as a result of them taking over the Senate.
I hope that even though it seems bleak now, that there can be not such a stalemate, which is we're already seem to have been experiencing even before the elections on Tuesday. But hopefully that there can be a more aggressive progression, so to speak, in terms of like now that the House and the Senate are together, but hopefully it won't be just like a veto versus,
Okay, aggressive progression towards what?
Towards getting bills passed in terms of,
like what type of bills do you look forward to seeing Republicans being in power getting passed? Like what are the tenets of the party that you're supporting?
More for the economic front. I mean, and we're doing pretty stably right now to forward that. I'm always more interested into, a less government less government inside, inside our... Just stop it. less government in, the domestic sphere, but more economic, aggression, and that's really what I think that the government should be there for. So with what Obama's already accomplished, with having the market is so strong, to continue that and not let this be again some sort of
Okay. All right. I hear what you're saying. But just so I can understand your belief, what aspect of quote-unquote Republican thinking do you see coming into play to improve the economy that would not have come into play if the Democrats were in power?
To invest more into to the businesses, into the companies. Like what Obama actually
did. Governments investing into the businesses?
Yes, and less, you know, of course, lesser taxes and more tax breaks. I agree with that. I know that doesn't sound like what anybody wants to hear. But
more tax breaks for businesses, you think,
and
will help
even the larger companies, the ones that and to see like an ability to like bring back more jobs back into America, more, you know.
You think the Republicans are against the outsourcing?
I hope they are. I hope that's what we voted for.
Well, you're Republican. I mean, did you vote on Tuesday?
Yes.
And who did you vote for? You obviously voted for a Republican senator, I'm assuming. So I'm just wondering what they stand for that you believe in. And again, I'm not challenging you. I'm just
No, that's
curious.
Okay. No. Again, a stability, you know, with business is really what I seek. I'm not, you know, I know immigration is a big, you know, taboo. Do I know what I stand on it personally? No. I can see.
Well, he's, you know, Obama has not been the friend of the immigrants, so that's, you know, I don't know what the difference there would be, but.
No, that's what I'm saying, though. I'm standing on the fence on that, personally.
Okay, so immigration you're on the fence on. But yeah. The main thing is you feel that the Republicans can improve the economy that's already been corrected from the mess that the Republicans put it in when Obama came into office.
I don't necessarily think it was a mess, but no, I think, you know, again, I'm not bashing anything with, you know, the Democratic.
You can speak freely.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
Say whatever you want.
But the one thing that, you know, I regretted when, you know, when the one thing that I thought that, you know, why I was pro-Romney, aside from the fact that I thought he ran a horrible campaign, and so I don't know if he would have had stamina for what's going on now internationally. But that's hindsight and it's irrelevant. But what, to my point, was that, you know, if Romney were had to, you know, being an, you know, entrepreneur and save a lot of companies, when, you know, from bankruptcy, that's the kind of politics that I look for, and hopefully that, you know, with the House and Senate majority, we can accomplish that. I don't like to as for overseas and foreign policy, you know, that might be where we can like definitely
use some improvement. You mean the Republicans use some improvement in their foreign policy concepts? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think.
Or are you saying the United States?
I think Obama can use improvement.
So you think the Republicans can help with foreign policy, or that's what you're hoping?
I'm hoping that they can bring in some more, you know, more point of views, you know, in Obama's, you know, cabinet choices, or you know, I'm not sure there's much salvation with Kerry. I think that's a lost cause. I'm, you know, flabbergasted that he was even appointed. But, you know, he's there.
All right. Well, Elena. Byron, anything you want to add to what Elena has laid out here for us, her hopes of the Republican majority in the Senate? Any direct responses to anything she said?
Sure. The country's economic condition right now is the rich are making more money than they've ever made in the history of the United States. So you mean to tell me having, if we had followed that concept of having the economy at its best that it has ever been in the last 30 years, and with the wealthy, we get really the money that they've made in the last 7 months has been just, it's been out of control. It's absolute greed. But to tell me that to have the Republicans improve the economy only means that they're going to make them even more wealthy. So the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Unemployment is at 5.8%. Where are the jobs that the Republicans have been promising for the last 30 years? It's a bunch of crock. They have not created a single job. They've outsourced all the jobs from America. Look at Detroit. Detroit is a mess. It's just coming out of bankruptcy right now. But when we talk about a city which represents the American ideal of capitalism, we're talking about the car industry. Detroit is a mess because they outsourced all of those jobs to foreign countries. War. Now, you don't want, you get upset with Obama for using drones, but guess what? Drones have saved American lives.
And money.
So now you're telling me you want to go back to an economy that's driven by war, creating more and more weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I find that abhorrent. I find it just obscene what we're doing, because countries like Germany, France, Great Britain, Israel, South Africa, and the United States are all arms merchants. So they can't and they won't to stop the manufacturing of weapons of mass destruction, because it's war that is fueling their economies, all of them. Israel's economy is being fueled by war. And that's insane, because at the end of the day, war is only good for one thing, and that is the elimination of the enemy, which is a genocide concept. I'm totally against that. I don't want to see another war fought. I want peace on this planet, and we can afford to have peace, because right now, we got so many weapons out there, we're even passing them down to the police force, which is making our cities armed fortresses of police. That's fascism. We need to get out of the confrontation business of war and get back to peace. I don't want to see what's getting ready to happen in Ferguson, but I got to tell you, we're about to step into the twilight zone as a country, because this race issue is exploding all over the place. And as much as Ebola and the health scare has created a situation, racism in America is worse than Ebola has ever been.
You saw that video I sent you of that little girl.
Yes, I did. And it's sad that we're moving in a time frame for which if we don't stop and turn back now, we are headed for another civil war, and it's not going to be very pretty at all. It's going to be very ugly. In fact, it's already ugly. And the attack on women, that's Republican initiatives. The attack on people of color, that's the Republican initiatives. In the way in which the rebuking of the civil rights laws for voting rights, do you know that 37% of the voter electorate participated in the 2010 midterms, and it's worse than that in the 2014 midterms? If there's anything that's going on, it's called voter suppression. Democrats and Republicans better get it together, because 37% is not a majority. In fact, that if we go by Robert's Rules of Order, which is supposedly our guidelines for constitutional rights and democracy in this country, we are out of order. If you don't have enough to have parliamentary procedure, that's called being out of order. And right now we have politicians who are not voted by the majority. So it's like we don't have a quorum. We have people who are obstructing the federal government. They are men and women who are employees of the federal government, and they're participating in what is actually criminal acts of sedition and treason. That's what's going on in Washington right now, and that has to be stopped. Because if we don't stop it and have some kind of law and order come back in to protect the rights of the Constitution, all of us are going to lose our rights. So we really have a serious situation that's ongoing, and it's more than just economy. It's more than just the war. It's more than just no jobs. It's more than bad education. It's more than a whole lot of stuff, because it's wrapped up in what really is racism. And we got to stop it at all costs, because it's about to destroy our country. And I'm very fearful of that as we move forward in these next, 2 years? You mean to tell me they're going to all of a sudden be Republicans are going to be generous with trying to turn around and work with the administration.
I can't see that happening. All right, but listen, we're gonna go to the interview. But I just wanted to get a little feedback from the two sides of Night Shift, Byron and Elena. And they love each other, too. Okay. All right, so we're going to talk now with the director, the subject of A Plot for Peace, Jean-Yves Olivier.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm speaking with Jean-Yves Olivier. Welcome, Jean-Yves.
Hi.
So I have a question for you. Now, considering this documentary has been made, and now I guess in many ways your secret is out, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about you. You grew up in Algeria, and you were there during the 1960s, during the independence. What did you find similar when you first went to South Africa to do business in the early 80s during apartheid?
Exactly. I mean, I saw a very similar situation that the one I lived in Algeria, whereby two communities are starting to hate each other, are killing each other, and it's obvious that one community will win and at the cost of the other community, and which exactly happened in Algeria, where the whole called French community had to leave 1 million person in 3 months. But in South Africa, there was no way that they could flew anywhere because they had no other passport, and so the only way would have been for them to be killed or flew to the sea. And it was time to initiate a dialogue between the two communities so they can look at the future together, or at least accept each other.
Okay, well, you were the architect behind a very crucial meeting behind the political powers of both North and South Africa. Why did you care to make that happen?
I care because I am a human being, because I was there and I was just had the feeling that I was we were heading for a disaster, and I had the feeling that I can do something to avoid the disaster. So I just did what every human being would have done. I tried to avoid the disaster.
Well, you're very humble about it. There are many human beings who had been there many times. And some who lived there, but not many people had the vision or the tenacity to do what you did. I mean, looking back, do you feel that would you have done the same thing, or would you have done anything differently?
I am doing the same thing right now.
Okay. Well, now, let me ask you this. During the release of Major Du Toit, you were negotiating between various governments, six actually, and being able to explain to each one of them the ideology of the next without seeming like you were partial to one or the other. How were you able to pull that off?
Because you don't pack sides, and you don't give the other the impression that you are sided. Of course, like any human being, you have your feeling, you have your own conclusions, but you don't express them, and you act like you are impartial, and people have to trust you, and because the exchange of prisoners you are referring to, which involved six countries, not one document has been signed. It was just word per word. And we were successful to do it.
Yeah, well, once again, that is not, you know, it's easy to say now, well, we were successful, but this took months of negotiating, lots of money on your part, flying back and forth. What kept you going all that time? What was your end game? What did you have in mind, ultimately?
I had in mind, you know, when you succeed to get people free, and you take them out of jail. It's a fantastic reward. I mean, when I saw all these people going back home, returning to their family, that's a fantastic reward.
Sure, it is to me. But why do you think that it took you? Do you feel, I mean, I don't know what kind of faith you have or spirituality, but do you feel that because you saw what you could do and you were able to do it, that you were meant to do it?
Exactly. But then again, you go back to this, your initial question, which is basically motivation. Motivation were very simple. The motivation was that I had to do something because I had to do it. And as I told you earlier, mm-hmm. still go on and making things happening.
It's a pretty amazing documentary, and I'm surprised. You know, I'd heard your name a bit, but I never realized just how integral you were. What made you finally agree to this documentary now and to put it all out there, as it were?
Can you repeat the question? Because that's,
My question is, what made you decide that now is the time for you to do this documentary or to be part of this documentary?
Because between the time I was doing what you saw and other things, that was the time when Google didn't exist. And now you can't do anything totally anonymous. You have to accept that some people will find you and will talk about you. It was time that people knew about the story. And it was a time also because I am setting up a foundation for peace through dialogues, a very important foundation called the Brazzaville Foundation for Peace and Conservation. I expect this movie also to support the cause of the foundation, which is to conflict. Most of the people think that conflict is always solved by the victory of one camp on the other. I believe that there is a way to look for dialogue and to explore different ways to get out of conflict by making people understand each other.
Well, I think that you're one of the few people who literally practices what they preach, having a dialogue between countries. If this were the way all things were resolved, we probably would have a lot more people on the planet.
Yes, I hope so.
Well, tell me a little bit about what your involvement was in the Brazzaville Protocol.
Then again, your question, please.
No, I wanted to know a little bit about your involvement in the Brazzaville Protocol.
My involvement was very clear. I mean, I was not... You know, the Brazzaville Protocol as such has a very limited objective and conclusion. Mm-hmm. The Cuban will leave the soil of Africa in Angola, and the white South African will accept the independence of Namibia against this gesture of the Cuban. So, but... The Brazzaville Protocol, the Brazzaville spirit, was that around these official talks, let's call them this way, all the delegation of all Africa and the Russian and the Portuguese were there as well, because I created what we call observers' positions, and we had talks among ourselves, independently to the Brazzaville Protocol. And we were aiming one thing, which we succeed, that the South African apartheid delegation will come back with a signed agreement on the protocol of the protocol at Brazzaville, but will be immediately recognized. Will immediately recognize the ANC, the African National Congress, the freedom fighter in South Africa, as an accepted political party, leading the way automatically to the negotiation and the release of Nelson Mandela. So the Brazzaville Protocol is very simple. It's an agreement, but the Brazzaville spirit was that we got something much more important around this agreement.
Now, I'm going to maybe walk into some more dangerous territory here, but it seems to me that you've been able to achieve things in your lifetime that the United Nations has been unable to achieve. Why do you think that the individual with interests that are not specifically political other than the politic of people, why do you think you're able to succeed where the UN has not?
Because the UN has also some guidance. The Security Council will tell the UN what they can do or not. So basically, the UN is also sometimes sided, like the American are sided. If you think of a conflict of Israel and Palestine, everybody will admit that the Americans are tired, and they are supporting Israel, and they are arming Israel, and they are financing Israel. So how can you be a broker in a peace process when you start your negotiation by being sided on one side?
I agree. Well, you know, someone in the documentary makes the observation that all wars are fought the same way. Two sides trying to negotiate from a position of power. Do you think that that's the wrong way to approach things, or do you think that's just the way it is?
I think victory is not automatically to destroy the enemy. Victory also to build the future with the enemy.
I agree. Well, what do you think is, I mean, you exemplify some of the best aspects of human nature. And like you said, you're a human being, and that's why you did what you did. But at the same time, there are some more negative aspects. What do you see could be a solution that is not being sought out in Israel, for instance?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Well, the question is that you mentioned that you're a human being, and that's why you did what you did. And it's just basic human nature to do, hopefully, the right thing. But it's also human nature to do some really bad things. So from your perspective, what you see going on in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, what do you see that perhaps they're missing being so deep in it? Because it seems to me that you've been able to be objective because you don't have the same feelings about things.
Listen, as you kindly repeated, I am a human being. That doesn't mean that I don't have feelings.
Right.
I have feelings, but I will not express them, and I will try to be a neutral arbitrator in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. By giving this denomination to the conflict, you are already creating a conflict. In other words, you are limiting the solution in Israel and Palestinian conflict to two communities which are not dealing one with the other. When you have to think about maybe a better the environment around Israel, which has also its role to play for a peace solution.
What do you think young people, or what do you hope young people to maybe gain from this documentary and the things that you've done that maybe could influence things that happen in the future?
Yes, of course. This is one of the objectives of this movie. And that was one of the reasons I accepted to make it as well. I always tell, don't you think it's time that the young generation goes out and move, and not only being satisfied by clicking in front of their computer, I love or I hate, and then starting to feeling that they have done their duty and just thinking that they can go party. It's very important that the people can believe that as an individual, whatever level you are, just be active, just do things. And as an individual, you can achieve things. It's not impossible.
No, I agree. Why do you think? I mean, I think in America, as a particularly apathetic country, why do you feel that we're not being taught that? Do you feel that people don't necessarily grow up feeling that they have the power to change things?
Listen, the young generation rely now on the internet and on many things which don't encourage them to get out and to make things moving physically, like the older generation did in the past.
Now, tell me a little bit about how, at the beginning of your involvement in everything that went on in South Africa, did you hope or have any, belief that you might eventually help lead to the release of Mandela?
You know, when you are entering in a journey like the one I did, you don't know how long it will take. You don't know how it would end, if it ends at all. So of course, I never when I start my journey, I didn't have an objective, which was the release of Mr. Nelson Mandela. It happened that I did play a little role in his release, but I am. It was only a small story among other stories which make the story.
That's true, but you did have a large role that contributed to the end of apartheid, which, you know, in turn ended up leading to that. I mean, did you, and people have, there are all kinds of sayings and things like that. Did you ever doubt that you could achieve the things you set out to achieve?
Of course, you have no certainty in life. You cannot, you know, people have said to me, have been asking me whether it was an investment. Who is in the hell is going to invest in a story like that? and you don't know how long it will take. You don't know how much you are going to spend. You don't know if you are going to succeed. So it would have been the worst investment. So you do it because you have to do it. And you have to go to the end of it. And thanks God, in that issue, the end was very nice. That's at least to say.
This is very true. Now, would you tell me a little bit about the foundation that you have and what your goals are for that, and how they exemplify the values pretty much you've lived all your life?
Yes, you know, this movie is very important for many reasons. And one of the reasons is, you know, as I earlier said, we live in a different world today. It's the world of Google. And I need a structure body to permit me to continue what I was doing yesterday in secret and in confidence, and as an individual only. And is why I set up this foundation, the Brazzaville Foundation for Peace and Conservation. And we are under a charity regime, UK, because the most controlled regime for foundation in the world. You have to apply every year to get your stamp. We have an extraordinary patron, which is Prince Michael of Kent, and the foundation office is in Kensington Palace. We are having extraordinary trustees, of experimented trustees around us, people who have been involved in negotiation, like Dr. Who is a black African, but was involved, for example, on behalf of Mr. Mandela in the Irish settlement of the crisis in Ireland. And the foundation needs, as you said, a support, not financial support, but a moral support, which will permit us to present ourselves with a much stronger base than if we are acting as an individual.
What's next for you? What are you working on currently besides this organization? And how much time are you able to actually... Okay. Hello? Hello? Yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
You're back. Okay.
Yes, I'm back. I'm sorry. That's pretty powerful what you said. Now, my question is, how much time are you able to devote both to your business and to this organization versus, you know, having any kind of personal life?
Listen, number one, I've been able to devote enough time the necessary time, even if I was much more active in business. Now I have a good business, structure, I have people helping me in my business, so I tend to devote most of my time to the foundation and the conflict resolution.
Well, I have to say, you're a very inspirational man. You've achieved some things in your life that many organizations and nations haven't. What, I guess my last question to you is, what do you think the future holds in terms of how we're able to resolve conflicts in the future and the kinds of wars that may be coming, whether it's over resources or water or things like that? What do you think that there's... Are you hopeful?
both Mandela and Martin Luther King had a dream. And both of them are gone from planet Earth without having those dreams accomplished. The only thing I am looking for the future is to try to continue their dreams and to work for a better world. This is my... that would be my legacy. Let's continue to work for a better world. But probably I will die without having a fully settled world and beautiful world. But I hope it will be a little better when I leave.
Well, I think it already is. So I thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. And I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to meet you in person.
See you next time.
I would love to.
Only we listen to you, we'll be in contact with you, and next time I am in the States, let's have a cup of coffee.
I would love that. I mean, I don't know if you have an email or something you give me, but I would love to.
Okay. Our final interview is about, and I'm just going to read what it says here. Bitter Honey is a feature-length documentary presenting an intimate and emotionally charged portrait of three polygamous families in Bali, Indonesia. Okay.
Bali world.
Following these three families over a 7-year period, the film portrays the plight of Balinese co-wives for whom marriage is frequently characterized by psychological manipulation, infidelity, domestic violence, and economic hardship. Living in a society where men have the authority in many domains, these women have little voice in steering or protesting the conditions of their domestic lives. Bitter Honey draws attention to their struggle, documents the work of those taking steps in the better to better protect and empower them, and aims to trigger a wider conversation about contemporary polygamy and women's rights in Indonesia. Now, I have to say, one of the most insidious things about this polygamy there is that it's in the culture that even if you were tricked, as many of these women are, into marrying, because these men court them and they don't know that they're married to other women, and then they get pregnant, and then they're stuck in this situation, and if you were to leave your husband, in their culture, it means you lose your soul.
Right.
Well, there it is, Byron. I don't know what could be more of a restraint than just the spiritual restraint of like, well, you can't do that. So, it's a really, really powerful film. And that's what we're going to end off on. But one more thing, Elena.
Yes.
You had something you wanted to say behind. To defend your beloved Republicans, you wanted to say something?
No, that's fine.
No, you can say it. You're right here. Say it.
No, that's fine. I think we left it as it should be.
Elena, I want sparks to fly. So,
based on the based on the 37%, I did read about that, and like Biden makes a good point. But on the other hand, if people aren't willing to like go vote, then how is that, you know, a Republican fault?
Well, it's not just that they're not willing to vote. Okay, voting has been made very difficult.
But listen to me.
I'm going to tell you, because voting has been made very difficult for the average person, for the average working person. Not only that, and there are many states where you're intimidated not to vote. Where it's been documented many times where they're doing things to prevent you from voting, or your vote somehow just doesn't appear or get through. Am I right, Byron?
Yes.
You know exactly what I'm talking about. So the thing is, and you have to look at this. Now, I look at it from actually both sides. Voter, like, if you can file your taxes online, how is it that you cannot vote? How is it that you cannot vote online at this point in time? At this point in time, with all the kind of security and all the kind of technology we have drones that can kill people, and we can't find a better way to vote except in times that people can't get to voting because they have a job and because the lines are too long. It's antiquated. It's antiquated, and there's no reason for it to still be antiquated. There's no reason, really. Except that keeping this system is easy to corrupt. Am I right?
Yeah.
easy to corrupt, easy to buy.
There it is.
And it hasn't been corrupted from a Democratic.
No, that's what I'm saying. I say the same thing. I blame them both on that.
What I just said was basically about voter suppression. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are guilty because if only 37% of the people turned out to vote, they are the ones who are suppressing the vote. Not me. I'm not suppressing the vote. The corporations are not suppressing the votes. The Democrats
You're suppressing
and Republicans.
Fernando, though.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The Democrats and the Republicans are suppressing the vote together because they're not putting up candidates who are worth a dime.
Well, that's a whole other conversation.
You know?
Right.
And the voter, the voter public is saying, I don't like any of y'all. I don't like Washington right now, so why am I voting them back in?
I've had people say that to me, and I agree with both of you gentlemen on that. Like, I find that ignorant. I mean, if you don't like them, then that's
your
problem. On the internet, or rather, send the ballot to your ass.
Here's the deal.
But the people are going to be stupid.
Is that what you're campaigning on that platform? Send the ballot to your ass. Is that Elena says?
If you make it so easy,
send the ballot to your ass.
Then you have no.
Make it easy.
There's no reason. This is no reason for voting to be difficult. There's no reason for that.
But to your point, both of y'all's points, but you just said that, like, even like people said, I don't want to vote because I don't like anybody.
No. Well, if you could vote by pressing a button and make a difference, I mean, come on. People get on Twitter and people vote for stupid. What's these shows where you're voting? Yeah, there's the Voice and this. People sit and vote for that. People vote for that. But if it was a thing, if you had to go down someplace, take time off of work to go vote, as much as you may love that singer, you're never going to do it.
Right.
And you're never going to do it.
What's more important, America's Got Talent or the way the
Exactly. Exactly. You're going to tell me they can have a valid voting system for America's Got Talent and not a valid voting system for this country?
And once again, I'm going to go back to Robert's Rules of Order because that's what we base our Constitution on, is an agenda that has a formality to it. And in Robert's Rules of Order, it is very clearly stated that if you don't have a quorum, you cannot have a meeting. If you don't have the votes to override something, it's like we do run by Robert's Rules of Order in the Congress of the United States. It's a gentleman's game that they play there, based on Robert's Rules of Order.
Gentleman using the term lightly, obviously.
Yes, and women's game too. But then the concept of working in an orderly fashion, having a majority determine who's going to rule. And at this point, 37% is not a majority.
Is this true?
You're tuned to listen to
the majority is not voting. So listen, Robert, we have to go to this interview, and then we'll be back.
And slightly disturbing documentary called Bitter Honey. Robert, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, so my first question to you is, when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
Well, I've been professionally an anthropologist for the last 30 years, and anthropology is about telling about other cultures, other places, to the American public. So in that sense, I guess I've always been kind of an academic storyteller. But the film, I started doing film about 15 years ago and initially started filming my research, and then it kind of expanded out. And since 2000, we've made about a dozen documentaries on a wide range of topics on genocide, sex trafficking, mental illness, and our latest one is on polygamy.
Now, what was your first knowledge of what was going on in Bali, you know, or has been going on for all these years in Bali, and how did you approach it to do a documentary?
Yeah, I was doing a project on the mass killings in the mid-2000s, the mass killings in 1965, and from about 2002 to 2006, I'd spent hundreds of hours interviewing people about this event that were upwards of a million Indonesians were killed. And then when that project was finished, it resulted in a film called 40 Years of Silence, an Indonesian tragedy. I was interested in just in general the issue of the different forms and effects of violence in Indonesia proper. You know, Bali is one small island of 3 million Hindus in a sea of about 250 Muslims in Indonesia. And as part of this project on social violence and on gender-based violence, we started interviewing women, and it just so happened that a number of the women who were in these you know, abusive relationships. We're in also in polygamous families. And so we kind of reoriented the project to focus on understanding and explaining polygamy.
Well, you know, it's funny. When you watch this, you kind of see the echoes of similar thinking and you know, history and tradition in many cultures throughout the world, and even to some extent here in America. What's your, having worked on this project as long as you did, what are some of the most surprising statistics and things that you learned about this?
Yeah, I would say maybe not one of the most surprising, but as an anthropologist, but some, one of the most revealing was the way that culture operates in order to kind of structure and in some ways oppress women. So, for example, if a woman wants to leave a polygamous family, and in general what I found is most of the women are pretty unhappy, and I think that's quite human. You know, if you see your husband sleeping with other women, and generally in the United States you would get divorced. In Bali, in these polygamous families, it's just part of the, you know, the structure. So there's a degree of acceptance, but when your husband's also being abusive to you, is being psychologically and physically abusive, that's not really part of culture, even though it happens. So when women want to escape, it's very difficult, because in Bali is patrilocal, patrilineal, which means that women move into the men's compound, where men live in multi-generational families with their fathers and sons, and all the male relatives. So if a woman wants to leave, the children stay with the husband. So if a woman gets divorced, she loses her kids. The kids stay with the husband. She also loses all of her property and ability to inherit land or anything of value, because that also stays with the husband and the male children. She loses her soul, because Balinese believe in this kind of recycling of souls within a family system. So my soul would be the soul of my great-grandfather. When I die, my soul would descend down into my grandchildren. That's the belief. It's a powerful belief. And so when a woman gets divorced, they're cut off from their husband's kind of soul recycling, and so they lose their soul, and finally they lose their position in society, because unmarried women in villages have very, very low status. If you're divorced or widowed or a spinster, none of the other women in the village want to deal with you. So you lose.
Hello?
Position, or is that, I think the soul was the last thing, that women, unmarried women in villages have no position. Maybe so I'll just repeat that. Do you guys cut this, or this is...
Oh, yeah, no, I'll edit this. This is not live.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, you can continue.
Okay, so you lose your property, you lose your children, you lose your soul, and then you also lose your position in the village, because unmarried women or divorced women, spinsters, have a very, very low status in Balinese villages. Now, the women are generally, other married women in the village are afraid that these unmarried women will steal their husbands or come in as another wife. So you lose everything. And because these are cultural practices, they're relatively resistant to change. You know, they're supported in a lot of ways. So we are now, as a production company, trying to help women in abusive relationships, not just in polygamous families, but across the board. And we're helping, along with some Balinese activists and colleagues, to set up the first gender-based violence intervention program in Bali. There's not a program currently for 2 million women, some of whom are in abusive relationships, to help them get out of those relationships.
Well, I have to say, I can't imagine doing this documentary without wanting to do something about it. It's just, as you watch it, it's so matter of fact that it's shocking. But at the same time, I see echoes. You know, like you said, women are being oppressed in many cultures, and even in this country, we have a history. You know, there's a time, if you're a single woman, and you're not married, you might be a witch, or you're a spinster, or you're a whore, you're something lower.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think it is? Is it just men worldwide? Why do you think these things have developed in so many different cultures?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, these things mean why are women viewed in a particular way? I wouldn't say globally. I think there's, you know...
That's true. There are exceptions in culture. Native American culture didn't do that and things like that.
Yeah, and I think actually, you know, one of the positive and negative parts about globalization, but I think one of the positive parts of kind of there's a global emerging consensus about human rights.
Right.
And I generally think that's a good thing.
You know, definitely.
That didn't exist really 30 or 40 years ago, and there's now kind of global standards on a wide range of topics around human rights, around the rights of children, the rights of disabled people, the rights of women, and you know sometimes those very much go up against local culture, and then it becomes kind of a balancing act as you know you have to respect local society and practices. As an anthropologist, I'd be one of the last people to be involved in a project to point a finger at like a kinship system, like saying, "Oh, this is wrong, this is immoral, this is bad." That's not what we do as anthropologists. But at the same time, you have to look at things with open eyes. And when there are particular beliefs or practices that really contribute in very negative ways to people's, you know, physical and mental health, I think you got to look at those.
And well,
everything is relativistic at the end of the day. It's not really.
Well, you know, I agree with you, and I would think that, you know, to a certain extent, you know, if you're human and you have, you know, feelings about other humans, you're just going to want to do something.
Yeah.
So, now let me ask you, when you did this over a period of 7 years.
Yeah.
And without giving away too much of what happens in the film, because there are a number of things, you broke it down into different aspects of you know, the culture, the mm-hmm. children, the ancestry, the violence, all those things. How much footage did you have to edit down, and how long did it take you to edit?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a long project. So, you know, I lived in Indonesia in the 90s, and then I went back pretty much every year, and I'm a professor at UCLA, so I have a full teaching load and family, et cetera, so I couldn't live there for 7 years, but I did go back year after year. And so at the end of the day, how many hours of footage? I mean, we had hundreds of hours of footage.
Wow.
Hundreds of hours of interviews. I'd have to go and see, count it up, but it's, you know, easily over 300 or 400.
Wow.
Our documentary, easily. Yeah.
Now, how did you structure the narrative? I mean, how did you, you know, did you pick three families? Did you have more than that? Did it start to just shape up over time?
Yeah, you know, so when we did the initial cuts, it's interesting. We at first just told family stories, and we focused on the husbands. And then after a few cuts, I mean, the film went through like 34 major revisions over 2 or 3 years of editing. So we realized after the first few cuts that telling the men's story really wasn't the way to go, because it's, you know, they're not the most appealing characters. People aren't going to really identify with these guys. And it's actually the women's stories which are much more powerful, how they survive and adapt and in some ways kind of overcome. So the way we ended up structuring it is we asked ourselves a series of questions that we thought the viewers would ask. So, like, the initial question is, you know, why would a woman want to be a second or third or fourth wife? You know, in the United States, women generally don't like to be in that position. And so we kind of go about, the early parts of the film looks at, you know, how they fell in love and the role that deception played, because basically, you know, the men always lied to the girls they were courting. They were married. And I guess as married men do in the United States, they're going to lie in order to get what they want, which is generally, you know, forms of sexual intimacy with these women. And in some cases, often what you see is women get pregnant first and then they get married, because it's much worse to be an unmarried single mother in a village in Indonesia than to be a second or third wife. And in the case of Bitter Honey, they fall in love with the guy, and then the guy brings them back to their compound, and they find out they're married. And when they're there, they get married. We ask the serious question, why, what, how do they manage their economic?
You asked the question, how do you manage?
I guess if this happens again, I'll just call you on my cell.
Okay.
I don't know why the phone keeps cutting out, you know, so I'm just sitting here.
I don't know. You were saying you asked the question, how do they manage? I think you were going to say financially.
I'll just kind of start.
Sure.
I'll just start. Okay. We ask these series of questions, you know, why would a woman marry, how do these women meet their husbands? And so we ask a question of how do the children adapt? How is kind of power distributed in the family? How can women endure such relationships? So we ask these series of questions. How does the kind of sexual life go if a man is sleeping with four or five different women, over the course of a week? How do they kind of manage all that? So we ask this series of questions, and then the film goes about answering them kind of one after the other. So by the end of the film, you have a pretty complete picture of what these women's lives were like.
Hmm. Well, some of the stuff in there was pretty shocking. One of the polygamists not only has a number of wives, but also visits brothels where there are all kinds of, you know, diseases like AIDS that he could potentially bring home. What's your take, having interviewed these men? What are they trying to satisfy by constantly just bringing more and more women, having more and more conquests? What's your take on this?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because if you look kind of local ideologies about what women say about why polygamy could be a good thing, they often say, well, if a man has multiple wives, that must mean that, you know, he's satisfied at home and he doesn't need to go outside the family, if not the family includes, you know, three or four wives. But that turned out not to be the case, that these guys, even though they're technically, you know, have a choice of different sexual partners at home, they're still going out and being, you know, what's termed, they're going out and being players. They're going out and trying to find other wives or girlfriends or, you know, sexual encounters outside the family. So what does that say about either these men or, you know, men in general? I think your listeners can make their own suppositions about, so there are some men who, it's never enough. Now, if you want to call that sexual addiction, it didn't make it into the film, but we interviewed a local psychiatrist who believed that these men were, you know, sexually addictive or compulsive. Now, I don't have the evidence one way or another to say that, but it was clear they had fairly prodigious sexual appetites.
That's
with having four wives.
This is for sure, not to mention the fact that, you know, these are, you know, there's a play that is almost a framing device you use that talks about Balinese culture or Indonesian culture, that talks about all these issues. And, you know, there are these tenets that say you have to be able to support the wives. It didn't seem like any of these men, with the exception of the one who's descended from royalty, are really supporting these women.
Right.
So what's your take on that? What the culture says, and then what is actually being done?
Yeah, that's a great point. So we thought, you know, I use a lot of narrative devices in films. You have a voiceover, a question in the beginning, you have a subject narrating, and for this, we decided to have what's called a lion kulit. It's a shadow puppet play, which is a very traditional artistic form in Indonesia, very respected artistic form, and the kind of contemporary shadow puppets, they grapple with contemporary issues. I mean, they deal with classic. The traditional shadow puppets deal with Mahabharata, Ramayana, these classic Indian epics, and they tell those stories. But they also have these kind of clown-like trickster figures, Tualin and Murdaugh, these two little fat puppets who often kind of say the truth. They're clowns, they're pranksters, and so they became kind of the narrators of the film. And they also questioned, you know, why are men like this? They're the ones who were able to put those questions to the fore.